So this morning, I'm going to talk about the Buddhist path. What a novel idea. And I'm going to read a bunch of... Come on in. Read a bunch of stories. So, the Buddhist path starts with aspiration, which I've been talking about quite a bit in my talks over the last few years. Aspiration. Aspiration involves imagination, doesn't it? Imagination travels beyond our limited experience. And we imagine that we could have an awakening like Buddha did, supposedly Buddha did. And if we don't resonate with the Buddha story because he dissed his wife, we can imagine we had an awakening like Yasodhara did, his wife, in the alternative myth. We can imagine. We need to imagine. Without our imagination, we won't do this path because we're just stuck in this very finite, limited, complaining psyche and body. So we see others' openings as possibly our own. When I met my teacher, when I got to know him, I saw his openings as possibly my own. If I hadn't had that imagination, I wouldn't be here now doing this. No way. I imagined that. I aspired to it. So here's, I'm starting with a story, which I continue to find inspiring. This is from a book by Christina Feldman and Jack Kornfield. Just a bunch of stories. That's all it is. Just a bunch of stories. It happened just a few years ago to two young children and a family from Illinois. The 8-year-old daughter became ill and was diagnosed with a life-threatening blood disease. A search went out to find a donor of blood compatible with her own. As she weakened, they looked and no donor could be found. Then it was discovered that her 6-year-old brother shared her rare blood type. The mother and their minister and doctor sat down with the boy to ask if he would be willing to donate his blood to save the life of his sister. Much to their surprise, he did not answer right away. He wanted some time to think about it. 6-year-olds can be quite thoughtful at times. After a few days, he went to his mother and said, "Yes, I'll do it." The following day, the doctor brought both children to his clinic and placed them on cots next to each other. He wanted them to see how one was helping the other. First, he drew a half pint of blood from the younger boy's arm. Then he moved it over to his sister's cot and inserted the needle so her brother could see the effect. In a few minutes, color began to pour back into her cheeks. Then the boy motioned to the doctor to come over. He wanted to ask a question, very quietly. "Will I start to die right away?" he asked. You see, when he had been asked to donate his blood to save the life of his sister, his 6-year-old mind understood the process literally. That's why he needed a few days to think about it. And then he simply gave what it is in the heart of every human being to give when we are truly connected. You imagine this? You aspire to this? That's possible, isn't it? It's possible. It's possible. If a 6-year-old boy can do it, it's possible we can do it too if we aspire to it. Isn't it? Isn't it? Instead, this is what we do. Instead, this is what we do. A man found an eagle's egg and put it in the nest of a backyard hen. The eaglet hatched with a brood of chicks. They grew up with him. All his life, the eagle did what the backyard chickens did, thinking he was a backyard chicken. He scratched the earth for worms and insects. He clucked and cackled, and he would thrash his wings and fly a few feet into the air. Years passed, and the eagle grew very old. One day he saw a magnificent bird far above him in the cloudless sky. It glided in graceful majesty among the powerful wind currents, with scarcely a beat of its strong golden wings. The old eagle looked up in awe. "Who's that?" he asked. "That's the eagle, the king of the birds," said his neighbor. "He belongs to the sky. We belong to the earth. We're chickens." So the eagle lived and died a chicken, for that's what he thought he was. Okay? You have your choice. You take your choice. We take our choices moment by moment. Moment by moment. We make our decisions. We take our choices. So aspiration. And once we've generated aspiration, some aspiration through whatever moves us, then we want to discover our own path. We think we want to discover the right path, but there are so many different ways of doing meditation practice, so many different spiritual traditions. I don't recommend trying to find the right path. Well, you can do it if you want. Here's a story about that. Here's a story about that. The two disciples of an old rabbi were arguing about the truth path to God. One said that the path was built on effort and energy. You must give yourself totally and fully with all your effort to follow the way of the law, to pray, to pay attention, to live rightly. The second disciple disagreed. It's not effort at all. That's only based on ego. It's pure surrender. To fall away to God, to awaken, is to let go of all things and to live the teaching. Not my will, but thine. As they could not agree on who was right, they went to see the master. He listened as the first disciple praised the path of wholehearted effort. And when asked by this disciple, is this the true path? The master said, you're right. The second disciple was quite upset and responded eloquently by describing the path of surrender and letting go. When he finished, he said, is this not the true path? And the master replied, you're right. A third student who was sitting there said, but master, they can't both be right. And the master smiled and said, you're right too. So rather than trying to find the right path, just find a path that resonates with you, that resonates with you. And you know, Zen, the way it's been passed down to us, we both have traditional surrender practices. If you do one of our, if you come here early in the morning, especially on a Tuesday morning, or you do Rahatsu, it's all about surrender. It's all about giving yourself away. It's all about bowing and chanting. But we also have just Zazen, just sitting. It's all about effort. It's all about just watching the mind. So those are just different ways. You know, some people do both. I always do both, but some people prefer one, some people prefer the other. Some people prefer to do the Jesus prayer. Some people prefer, just find what resonates with you and stay with it, please. Stay with it rather than righting and wronging it. People right and wrong religion to death, and they right and wrong each other to death. So Zusha told his students, when I die, God will not ask me, was I like Moses or was I like Joshua in my life? He will ask me, was I Zusha? You find yourself. You find yourself without trying to do the right practice, but a practice that resonates. And then once you've decided on your path, maybe your path is to practice here with me or someone else. Maybe it's to practice here and come on Tuesdays and sit at home much of the time. Maybe it's to practice someplace else. Then stick with your path. Just stick with it. And try to maintain some balance on the path that you've chosen. Try to maintain some balance. We call it the middle way in Buddhism, right? Balance. When I was a kid growing up in California, before surfboards, really before surfboards, I body surfed in the Pacific Ocean. And, you know, my body, we didn't know about surfboards, but we know about body surfing. And I learned to body surf when I was pretty young. Body surfing is just making your body like the board, although we didn't know anything about a board. You know, you just make your body, but if your body is too stiff, you can't really go with the waves. And if your body is too flaccid, the waves just mash you. You just get mashed. So if you have to find your balance, your poise. Sometimes we need a little more effort. We're getting a little bit flaccid. Sometimes we just need to relax more into what is. Forget this effort stuff. We're overdoing it in our body, in our life, in our relationships. Always trying to come back to the balance, finding the balance. And when we're off balance, having a spiritual friend is very good. Could be a teacher, but it really needs... Teacher is not so important as spiritual friend. Someone who kind of gets what we're up to, who's been through it, and will be there with us. Be there with us. For example... let's see. The whole family went out to dinner one evening. Menus were passed to all, including Molly, the 8-year-old daughter. The conversation was an adult one, so Molly sat ignored. That's rude, isn't it? When the waiter took orders, he came to Molly last. "And what do you want?" he asked. "A hot dog and a soda," she said. "No," said her grandmother. "She'll have the roast chicken, dinner, carrots, and mashed potatoes." "And milk to drink," chimed in her father. "Would you like ketchup or mustard on your hot dog?" asked the waiter as he walked away, taking the parents aback. "Ketchup," she called out. Then she turned to her family and added, "You know what? He thinks I'm real. He thinks I'm..." That's what we want in a spiritual friend. That's really what we want. Someone who thinks we're real. When we're in a funk, when we're depressed, when we're spun out with tripping out and all the great things we're going to do, someone will be there with us who thinks we're real, who won't put us down and say, "Oh, your practice is this and that and the other." Our practice is what it is. We are what we are. That's what we want. And that will help you with your balance. It always helps me with my balance. Just to turn to a spiritual friend always helps me. But people always want to give us some advice. This is not real deep spiritual friendship. Not deep spiritual friendship. And, of course, when we're having a hard time and we feel like we're out of balance, often we just want to withdraw. "Oh, this Zen community, these people are crazy. You know, I'm supposed to coming here to get calm, but everybody's tripping me out." They're behaving like, I don't know, you know. I hear this all the time, and I experience this all the time. I remember when I was a young man at Tassajara, the Zen monastery, I thought, "My God, these people are here to meditate?" They only seem to be here to have affairs and gossip. But that was my judgment, wasn't it? That was my judgment. We're human beings. We're just fallible, right? So when we're out of balance, we want to withdraw. We want to, you know, withdraw. Not this Zen center. I'll try that one. "Oh, no, I've done enough of these Zen centers." Unitarian Church. "Well, try the Unitarian Church for a while." I was a Unitarian. Just human beings. We're all human beings hanging out together, right? So, What's the teaching about this? Here's the teaching about this. A brother asked Abba Mateos, "What shall I do? My tongue causes me trouble, and whenever I am among people, I'm out of balance. I can't control it, and I condemn them in all their good deeds and contradict them. I'm out of balance. What therefore shall I do?" The old man answered him, "If you cannot control yourself, go away from people and live alone. But this is a weakness. Those who live together with others ought not to be square, but round, in order to turn toward all." Further, the old man said, "I live alone, not because of my virtue, but because of my weakness. You see, those who live among people are the strong ones." So this takes some strength to come back into this social world, into this inner person, into this dysfunctional family. It's a dysfunctional family, yes. Have you ever met a family that's not dysfunctional? So what's the mean? Why do you even need dysfunctional any? It's an extra word, isn't it? We're just trying to do our best. We're all just trying to do our best. Let's not run around, run off and diss each other. Okay. Let's be round together. Let's be round. Let's rub our edges up against each other until we return to our original roundness. That's practice. That's Zen practice. That's Zen life. So the main pitfalls to balance, assuming we work with a spiritual friend, assuming we find a community and stick with it, what are the main pitfalls? Well, I think there are a couple main pitfalls that I made up for today. they sound pretty good to me. We'll see if they sound good to you. Okay. The first main pitfall is the intrusion of belief. Well, I didn't make that one up. That's core Zen, right? The intrusion of belief. Belief intrudes. Okay, so here are two stories about the intrusion of belief. One day, Mara is a devil, you know. In this story, it says the Buddhist god of ignorance and evil was traveling through villages of India with his attendants. He saw a man doing walking meditation whose face was lit up in wonder. The man had just discovered something on the ground in front of him. Mara's attendants asked what that was, and Mara replied, "A piece of truth." "Doesn't this bother you when someone finds a piece of truth, O evil one?" his attendant asked. "No," Mara replied. Right after this, they usually make a belief out of it. Okay. All right. You don't have to explain that one. Okay, here's the last one. The last belief story. When the guru sat, I've told this one before. When the guru sat down to worship each evening, the ashram cat would get in the way and distract the worshippers. So he ordered the cat be tied during evening worship. After the guru died, the cat continued to be tied during evening worship. And when the cat expired, another cat was brought into the ashram so that it could be duly tied during evening worship. Centuries later, learned treatises were written by the guru's scholarly disciples on the liturgical significance of tying up a cat while worship is performed. Oh, you should do some of our ancient rituals. Come on Tuesday morning. So the intrusion of belief, and I think the second thing that gets us off balance, and you know how quickly beliefs get us off balance. I mean, it's really fast. Starts from just some innocent, beautiful sort of experience, and then we glom onto it and turn it into a belief, and we just get off balance. So I think the second main way we get off balance is by through fear of intimacy, which I talk a lot about too. But I don't know if I've ever read this story before. Oh, probably I have. Fear of intimacy. Intimacy is, we're afraid of intimacy because we're afraid we'll lose something. But you know, Zen practice is all about losing something. It's all about losing something. So anyway, here's a story. A lover pressed his suit with a woman unsuccessfully for many months, suffering the atrocious pains of rejection. Finally, his sweetheart yielded. "Come to such and such a place at such and such an hour," she said to him. At that time and place, the lover found himself seated beside his beloved. He then reached into his pocket and pulled out a sheaf of love letters that he had written to her over the past months. They were passionate letters expressing the pain he felt and his burning desire to experience the delights of love and union. He began to read them to his beloved. The hours passed by, but still he read on and on. Finally, the woman said, "What kind of a fool are you? These letters are all about me, and you're longing for me. Well, here I'm sitting with you at last, and you're lost in your stupid letters." Fear of intimacy, right? Fear of intimacy. And it's so true in Zen practice. It's so true. The ability to return to your original stillness is very close to you. Very close. You seem to get the aspiration, but then you retreat. You retreat because you're afraid. You're afraid of losing yourself. But when you lose yourself, you get something huge. It's not a thing. You get something huge that you've always had. So if we continue to do our practice on our path, and we continue to balance ourselves more in balance, bring ourselves back, not too soft, not too hard, but just in balance, then we do begin to experience moments, times of letting go into freedom from belief, from no belief, from worry, from fear, from expectation, from death, so that we can just be and let go of the fixed sets of who we are, who I am. And what do we let go of? Well, one thing we let go of is boredom. Boredom is a big part of Zen practice. If you don't know it's a big part of Zen practice, you haven't done much Zen practice. Just do some retreats. Boy, what an invitation to a retreat. What a way to invite you in. To just be there with your mind. Just be there with your mind and nothing else. And you will experience, unless you're totally tripped out, you'll experience boredom. But you can't trip out the whole time. So boredom. That's one of the things we need to let go of. And here's a... But it lets go when it's ready. First we have to see it. And you know, my teacher Suzuki Roshi, I don't remember him ever being bored about anything. I don't remember. This is your open mind. It's not bored. It just takes everything. Why do we get bored? What is boredom all about? Boredom's about not being comfortable enough to be intimate with what's going on, right? But really, can you think about a situation where you really need to be bored? You know, driving in the car, there's always something to see. Wow, there's always something to hear. Coming over here this morning, wow, that was wonderful. Oh, you might have said it was awful. And then I got here and I couldn't tell whether it was raining or snowing. There's always something here. So boredom is our monkey mind distraction, isn't it? But we do it. We become addicted to it. And then in our meditation, we see what a big addiction it is. And we want some other kind of meditation than just this. We want mantra meditation or chanting meditation or triple yoga meditation. You won't get bored if you do hot yoga meditation, right? Everybody does hot yoga meditation these days. You don't get bored in that. Wow. Oh, monkey mind, right? Human being. That's okay. We are a monkey mind. No big deal. Okay, so what does this guy say about boredom here? This is Father Theophany. Father Theophany, your good friend and mine. On my way up there, I met a beggar and went over to give him some money. My saintly mother had taught me never to pass a beggar without giving him something. But he took my quarter and said with a look of disdain, flipped it into the bushes, "I don't need your money," he barked. "Why don't you give me your boredom?" What could I say? I heard myself saying, "I'll have to ask my wife." And I hurried out on before he could devastate me further. Well, there were other things I had planned to think about on my retreat, but his words kept breaking in. "Why don't you give me your boredom?" "No, I can't. Not that. I'll have to ask my wife." "Can't I give you something else? You'd understand my situation." "I won't." For 40 days I resisted. On the 40th day I rose up, left the monastery, and dumped my boredom into his lap. Do you know what he said? That's the end of the story. Okay, we can have him say thank you. So boredom is one of the things that we have a capacity just to see and let go of. Let go of. Not necessary. Not necessary. And then ultimately, of course, what we're letting go of is our fixed sense of identity. To be authentic, become authentically who we are, we let go of this fixed sense of Tim being so-and-so and needing such-and-such. And we let go of that. And then we become authentically who we are because we're intimate with just this. Whatever that this is, we don't know. We're just intimate with it. So here's a couple of classic stories about letting go of our little fretting and moaning identity. Or big fretting and moaning identity. Giant fretting and moaning identity, right? This is actually one of the first. Now, this is one of the first stories I read before I did Zen, and it's from either the Vedas or the Upanishads. I can't remember, so it's pre-Buddhist. There was a child made all of salt who very much wanted to know where he had come from. So he set out on a long journey and traveled to many lands in pursuit of this understanding. Finally, he came to the shore of the great ocean. "How marvelous," he cried, and stuck one foot in the water. The ocean beckoned him in further, saying, "If you wish to know who you are, do not be afraid." The salt child walked farther and farther into the water, dissolving with each step, and at the end exclaimed, "Ah, now I know who I am. Now I know who I am." And here's Rumi. Rumi knocked on the door of his beloved. "Who is there?" came the answer. "It's I, your lover, Rumi." Rumi's got so much emotion. We need some of Rumi's emotion to some of these old Zen guys. You know, really. "It's I, your lover, Rumi," he said. From inside came the voice, "Go away. There's no room for the two of us in here." Rumi went off in his meditations and prayers. To do his meditations and prayers. Later, he returned to the house of his beloved and knocked again. "Who is it?" the beloved asked.
"It is you."
With a welcome, the door was thrown wide open. This is what we do in Zen. We do this practice. We do this practice. We forget about accomplishing anything. and we begin to let go of all the stuff that weights us down, all the stuff that burdens us. And then, voila, at some points it's gone completely. It's gone completely. And we're intimate with just this. With just this. And as we do this practice, we find that we're able to help people. We're able to help people. And we, but we don't, and we say we teach, but we don't teach. we teach through being, not through teaching something. It's true we teach lots of stuff here, but that's not the important, what we really do. We teach through being. Gandhi was asked if he had any message for the world. He said, "My life. My life." That's what we're about. That's what we're about. Our lives. Our lives. Katagiri, my teacher here, said, if we wish to have peace, we be peace. And you hear this, it's almost a cliche. But it's not a cliche, you guys. We do it. We practice it. We be it. We be it. So, I think there are a few different components for to teaching through being, and I'm suggesting today that they are humility, lack of self-consciousness, compassion, and not knowing. And wouldn't you know that I found a story for each of these? Humility. Rabbi Elimelech once set out for home from a city he had visited, and all the Hasidic Judaism accompanied him for a long stretch of the way. When his carriage drove through the gate, he got out, told the coachman to drive on, and walked behind the carriage in the midst of the throng. The astounded Hasidim asked him why he had done this. He answered, "When I saw the great devotion which you were performing, the good work of accompanying me, I could not bear to be excluded from it." Humility. So when I first went to, started going to homeless camps 16 years ago with my friend Patrick, when Patrick went to the homeless camps, the first thing he told me was to dress down, to completely dress down, and then just to pay attention when I was there. Just to pay attention. Just to try to be with people, and if they offered me cold coffee, to take a cup of cold coffee. If their hands look cold, to offer them some mittens, but if they rejected them, not to make a big deal of it. And I learned from Patrick how just to go to those homeless camps without anything and become one of them, become one of those people. And, you know, because Patrick was able to do that, he was able to then, little by little, morning after morning, because, you know, practice is daily. If you don't do daily practice, you shouldn't do Zen. You're not a Zen student. Practice is daily. He went out to those camps every morning. This was before the cops figured out where all the camps were. Now that nobody knows where the camps are, but this was 16 years ago, right? And he had 100 best friends who lived outside. 100 best friends who lived outside. And he kept them alive by giving them water in the summer, because they more died from dehydration than they did from the cold. But he did it through humility. They're not being a big deal. They're not talking to anybody about it. They're not announcing it. They're not acting like he was a stupid social worker. God, we've got too many of those social workers around. He was just a human being. A human being. He was humble. He was of the earth. This is our nature, to be of the earth. We are earthy. But we get so caught up in all this stuff, we forget our natural humility. So, teach through being. Humility. Humility. Lack of self-consciousness. If you keep doing this practice sincerely, a lot of your self-consciousness is going to go away. It just goes away. You know, self-consciousness we need to a degree, but don't we overdo it? A lot of it just goes away. As you're able to be more intimate with what is, then self-consciousness, it's important to a degree, yes, but we way overdo it. We way overdo it. So here's Chuang-tzu. There's Chuang-tzu. In the age when life on earth was full, no one paid any special attention to worthy men. Patrick was not a worthy man. Patrick was depressed. Patrick had chemical dependency himself. Patrick, I can go on. He was not a worthy man. Don't become a worthy man. Really. It smells. It's odoriferous. Be who you are. In the age when life on earth was full, no one paid any attention to worthy men, nor did they single out the man of ability. Rulers were simply the highest branches on the trees, and people were like deer in the woods. They were honest and righteous without realizing they were doing their duty. They were doing their duty. They loved each other and did not know this was love of neighbor. They deceived no one, yet did not know they were men to be trusted. They were reliable, and did not know that this was good faith. They lived freely together, giving and taking, and did not know they were generous. For this reason, their deeds have not been narrated. Not been narrated. They made no history. Pretty cool, huh? Pretty cool. Lack of self-consciousness. Compassion. Compassion. Well, I don't need to talk about compassion, but I'll read a story. Read a story about compassion. This is Bankei Zen Master, one of my favorite Zen masters, not in the Soto tradition, not in the Rinzai tradition, in his own tradition. When Bankei held his seclusion weeks of meditation, pupils from many parts of Japan came to attend. During one of these gatherings, a pupil was caught stealing. The matter was reported to Bankei with the request that the culprit be expelled. Bankei ignored the case. Later, the pupil was caught in a similar act, and again, Bankei disregarded the matter. This angered the other pupils, who drew up a petition asking for the dismissal of the thief, stating that otherwise they would leave in a body. When Bankei had read this petition, he called everyone before him. "You are wise, brothers. You know what is right and what is wrong. You may go somewhere else to study if you wish, but this poor brother does not even know right from wrong. Who will teach him if I don't? I'm going to keep him here even if all the rest of you leave." A torrent of tears cleansed the face of the brother who had stolen. All desire to steal had vanished. Compassion. And the last one is not knowing. Zen really begins and ends with not knowing. At first we hate not knowing, but afterwards, later, when you really steep yourself in this practice, you groove on it. You groove on it. Yeah, here we are. Where are we? 203. Not knowing. A businessman needed to attend a conference in a faraway city. Needing to attend a conference in a faraway city, decided to travel on country roads rather than the freeway so he could enjoy a relaxing journey. After some hours of traveling, he realized he was hopelessly lost. Seeing a farmer tending his field on the side of the road, he stopped to ask for directions. "Can you tell me how far it is to Chicago?" he asked the farmer. "Well, I don't rightly know," the farmer replied. "Well, can you tell me how far I am from New York?" "Well, I don't rightly know." "Well, can you at least tell me the quickest way to the main road?" the exasperated businessman asked. No, I don't rightly know. You really don't know very much at all, do you? Nope, but I ain't lost. Not knowing. So, teaching through being. Humility, lack of self-consciousness, compassion, not knowing. And of course, the way I do this in this nice linear way, then I have to negate all this. Because there's no final enlightenment. There's no final enlightenment. It's just a spiral. Mula mula. Sufi story. Mula mula. My son has written me from the hall of practice to say that he has let go of all his difficulties. Console yourself, madam, with thoughts that God will send him more soon. And then, more aspiration. We have to generate the aspiration again. More difficulty is coming. And the next moment, a new difficulty is coming. When you come home, go home to see your child or your wife or whatever, or your cat, a new difficulty is coming. A new chance for aspiration, for imagining yourself beyond the confines of just pissing and mowing about your cat not behaving well, your wife not behaving well, right? And then back to our practice. And we get out of balance, we just come back in. And then we find ourselves letting go. We find ourselves shedding all kinds of things. Until ultimately we even shed this trying to shed. But it's not ultimate because a new difficulty will be coming along. What's ultimate? We don't know. We're just here, trying to be here with each other, trying to be here for ourselves and for each other. And sincerity. Well, we don't know what sincerity is. We just are here doing our best. But we don't know what best is. We don't care about best and worst. We don't get caught by that stuff, do we, you guys? Just trying to be here with each other. So, that's what I want to say for today. Comments? Questions? Kate? Pardon? This book is called Soul Food by Christina Feldman and Jack Kornfield. Kate.
My Tai Chi teacher, talking about that sort of making a belief out of something, and he talks about how when people get attached to the form instead of the principle, Bruce Lee had a problem with, I think, his ankle. I think it wouldn't, he had injured it and it wouldn't bend very far. And so he had to find his own way to do things. Mm. So he had this particular style that sort of accommodated his problem. Mm. And so people then started seeing him doing things in this unique way. And they thought, oh, the master is like, you got this. And so people would like make their ankles really rigid so that they could do things in this way that he had developed. They weren't originally designed to be done that way, but he had had to accommodate his shortcomings, and so people made this whole thing out of having strength and miracles.
Thank you. Hi.
What's your favorite belief that you've had to let go of?
My favorite belief that I've had to let go of. One favorite belief that I've had to let go of is that I'm enlightened. That's a favorite belief that I've had to let go of. Of course, I am enlightened, but so are you. We're enlightened together, though. In our intimacy. That's the expression of our enlightenment. But as soon as I say, I am enlightened, problem, right? Even if I have a wonderful opening, which you will have if you do Zen practice. And you say, I am enlightenment. You cut yourself off immediately, don't you? You're back in your little walnut self. Only it's this huge walnut self, right?